WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown. You're good at what you do, too.
She is Natalie Jacobson.
You are the dean of South Shore Broadcasters.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
Best-selling author, Dave Wedge. You got to say that.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mayor. Yes. Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Kevin's been a long time. Thanks for all you do. All you know, your local news icon. We appreciate it.
Kathy's doing a great job at this. And I've decided she's jelly. I got to be peanut butter.
There was a debate about
it.
There was a debate about that.
You fine with jelly?
I'm fine with jelly.
Okay, good. Jelly spikes my sugars.
Good evening and welcome to Monday Night Talk. As you know, I am not Kevin Tachi, and I'm going to be your host for the first hour with
Massachusetts State Auditor Diana DeZoglio. Welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Jermaine Wiggins, member of the 2001 Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. Welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Not just economic development, but it's how to get the businesses involved.
Senator, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you being a voice bringing so much community news to folks here on the South Shore.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 ATD, and I have to tell you, it's somewhat surreal. It's almost, we're in a bizarro radio show world, as normally I would look to my right to do the Redidio program, but today, because of the ongoing updates that are going on here at Broadcast House, I have to turn to my left. I'm not necessarily seeing my producer because there are monitors all over the place, but the place smells like fresh paint. It's like, you know, the first time you get into a new car. you get that new car scent for, 6 months, depending on spills and children and stuff like that. But we're hoping that we're able to get through the radio show with the new digs without any technical issues. We welcome Dave. Dave is my producer for this evening, so we're looking forward to chatting with him. Looking forward to him making the smooth transitions from one guest to the next guest to the next as we are. We do our best to bring some of the best talk here on the South Shore, and we have a fantastic lineup that, of course, our leadoff hitter, he's already here, ready, primed, and pumped. He'll join us in a second. He's none other than Greg Hanley. He is a Plymouth County Commissioner. We'll get our county update from him as we try to do a little bit of a rotation. Normally we have the chairman in, Chairman Valenzuela in, but it's kind of a dual role for Mr. Hanley, for the commissioner, because not only will he give an update, but we'll give him an opportunity to talk a little bit about, why you should, when it comes to September and November, to make him your number one choice as a returning county commissioner. So we'll talk with him about that. We do the State House Report. This is a staple of this show. We do our best to get in all of the legislators or constitutional officers to come on in and talk about what's going on up at the State House, what is going on, whether it's in a respective district or some of the bills that they're working on. Tonight, it is State Senator Sue Moran. She'll be stopping by. I'm going to talk with her a little bit about a child care bill, actually the Early Ed Act, looking to help folks who need assistance when it comes to child care, be able to work and balance the two and do it fiscally responsibly. So we'll talk with her about that. Hour number two, we will bring in the Monday Night Talks, a legal analyst. He's a defense attorney. He's also a marathon runner. He also has a dual role this evening. Chris DiOrio. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Karen Reed case. A lot that's been going on as of late. If you have been paying attention between having an FBI that had a special someone in from the FBI who actually has been able to break down some of the evidence in regards to Karen Reed backing into her longtime boyfriend, Officer John O'Keefe, and this reconstructionist who's been hired says that, in fact, his injuries do not appear to be from a car strike. Also to mention that there's a little bit of a question in regards to one of the state police's lead investigators. We'll talk to Chris about that. And also, His ongoing run, he's running this time again. He's going to be running the 127th annual Boston Marathon, doing it for the Mass General Hospital's Pediatric Cancer Clinic. We'll talk with him about that. And then we're going to close things out with John Berger. I think it's Dr. John Berger because he has a PhD at the end of his name. And he's the author of Solving the Climate Crisis. Well, I am willing to hear what this is because I don't know if it's something that can be done in short order, but we're going to talk to him about his new book and some of the, you know, his thoughts and theories as to how we could solve what's going on with, you know, not getting snow for 2 years in a row. You know, it's not really a bad thing for most people up here in New England, but just kind of keep that in mind because we are undergoing a crisis when it comes to our climate, rising seas, and all that. Am I correct, Mr. Hanley?
You are correct. And thank you for having me, Kevin. I have to say in the introduction, I wasn't sure where you were going with the room to the left and then the room to the right, but I want to say, just for your audience's sake, that I am firmly in the middle of this room, which, politically speaking, I'm firmly in the middle of being a liberal and a conservative. I am right down the middle, my friend. So,
okay.
Thank you for landscape.
We'll talk about the re-election stuff at the back half of your conversation.
Okay.
Anyway, kind of jump right into that. How are you doing?
Doing great.
You made it through St. Patrick's Day?
It's been a long month, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get one more event, and that'll be 20 days of celebrating St. Patrick just in the month of March. But as you know, I celebrate it every day, so it's not a problem, but it's a tedious schedule.
So the thought is to have you in and talk a little bit about the county update, how things are going on the county level. I think probably the first thing we want to kind of jump right into, and I try to make it a regular conversation because, again, I think folks, they don't realize a lot of the work that has been done since, and I don't say since COVID, but I feel that COVID allowed a lot of organizations and government bodies to either shine or sink to the bottom. I feel that Plymouth County government, it was an opportunity to seize a chance to show the viability and how important county government is and what your county government can do for you. Two prime examples, CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan Act. That was funding that was presented, that was given by the federal government by two different administrations. The Trump administration was the CARES Act, and of course the Biden administration is the ARPA funding. Do we have any updates in regards to where things stand with the CARES Act? Is that something that's kind of already run its course? Or is there still eyes on the money that were given out by the CARES Act?
Well, the CARES Act has been fully disseminated.
And, right.
You know, so we're on to ARPA. ARPA is a program that will extend for 2 more years after the 31st of December of this year. So the amounts of money that are distributed are committed, and then the county then has to oversee the use and make sure that the money that we've given is used for the intended project.
Is that something that's, how is that done? How's the county able to be assured? Is it a matter of a paper trail by the municipalities that they have to show proof? This is the money that we're giving us. Yeah, you gave us, you know, we showed up. The county commissioner showed up with a big Happy Gilmore sized check and said, here you go. Here is $1.5 million or whatever the amount may be. And, you know, because they had put forth an application seeking the funding, they basically have to kind of connect the dots saying, yep, here's our paperwork for, you know, for this project, that project, et cetera.
So we have to go back to CARES to understand how we administer ARPA. So if you go back in time, I think I spoke to you previously about a period of time from April 27th of 2020 to May 1st. There was a tremendous amount of pressure put on the county to take the money away from the state. And it was not an easy time to be the county commissioner. However, we felt that as a group that we had the ability with our county treasurer, with Emeritus Chairman Mr. Potter and ourselves to administer the program. But if you look at that period of time and just Google Plymouth County CARES, you'll see the amount of pressure we were put under. The governor wanted all of the money, and I am so glad that we took it because we were cited by Congress as having, in the whole country, the lowest administration cost for the money given. So we're very proud of that. So now transition to APA, we were able to convince the four other counties to take their distribution of APA funds. So our administrative cost was 1% under CARES, and it was 37% under the governor. At one time, the legislature actually quarantined his access to the remaining funds of CARES, and that was money.
Define his?
Governor Baker's program.
Just for the folks who weren't following along at home, they're not sure.
Yes. So, I mean, it was something that actually put county government back on the map. If you recall, Kevin, 12 years ago, I sat in this seat and ran for county commissioner. And when I got elected, there was a charter commission that was considering abolishing county government. There was a $750,000 structural deficit in the county. And here we are full of energy and promise on what we can do as county commissioners. And we were doomed from the start. So we were asked to put together some programming, and we developed programs like Plymouth County Solar, Plymouth County Trash. We actually procured the services of both of those entities, and then we started moving forward with some legislative options on monies that we were given that were not allowed to be carried over. So we petitioned the legislature for a stabilization account, the ability to put money away for a rainy day account. And then we move forward with our other programs like expanding and solving the maintenance of effort program. That was the county debt that was left over by the transition of the sheriff's department. And it was a pension liability at the time of about $7 million. And when they separated the county sheriff's department from the county, they left behind the legacy costs. And county, cities, and towns were going to have to pay that.
On the hook.
On the hook. So our first program that, again, working with our legislative delegation, we were able to have that money put on the deeds excise at about 10 cents more on the dollar until it was paid off. So that saved those member communities, all 27, about $7 million in retirement costs that we didn't have a source for funds. So the money that we get is by assessment by community, and then we get the money from deeds excise. And that's the money that's transacted at the Registry of Deeds that comes out of the transaction. And 90 cents on the dollar goes to the Commonwealth, and 10 cents on the dollar comes to the county. So we filed, actually, this fifth time we've filed legislation to address the inequity of that formula. At one time, it was 47 cents on the dollar. We've settled on a number of 27 cents on the dollar to hopefully be able to gain back money that's Plymouth County money that's transacted at the Plymouth County Registry for Plymouth County residents.
Right. And this you have been attempting, this is according to our pre-conversations, we normally prime the pump so folks don't have any air and there's no sputtering in our conversation here, but this is the fifth application that the county has put in seeking to up that level, that amount of 10 cents on the dollar to get back the money that the county has earned.
Right. In honestly, we had it to the finish line three times under the Baker administration. They just didn't want us to move forward as a county entity. In fact, every year in the budget, there was an amendment that or a line item that said, to abolish county government. And fortunately, because it's a three-legged stool, the other two sides on the budget, the House and the Senate, supported county government, and we've moved forward.
Okay. So, again, something that bears watching.
Correct.
Let's talk about the future of Plymouth County, county government, and some of the things that are in the works. Talk to me a little bit about a mobile integrated health program.
So, hopefully we get reelected. This is moving forward in partnership for some revenue-generating opportunities. Right now, it's on the drawing board. It is a program that would have to be procured. However, I'll go back to CARES.
Please do.
The town of Hanover put together this program for mobile integrated health within the confines of the town of Hanover. And if you recall, when everyone needed to be vaccinated, not everyone could get to a hospital or to a clinic. And by the way, Plymouth County did sponsor the Marshfield Fairgrounds when the governor didn't want to cover that spot on the map, and we funded that with the town of Marshfield with a town of Marshfield Fire Department to have that drive-through vaccination center. But for the folks that were elderly, disabled, or shut-ins, Hanover decided that they wanted to bring the vaccinations to the doorstep. So when you think of that, you know, that was quite a service. We provided the funding for an ambulance, and the town matched the grant opportunity with funding it with the fire department. So they would go out into these homes, identify the people, give them a wellness check, give them a vaccination, and throughout the period of CARES, they were on call for that kind of response, and it was a great program. Chief Blanchard was involved, and again, Tom O'Brien, and at the time it was Dan Pallotta, who was a Hanover former moderator. And so it was a test case, and now we're trying to elevate that to a higher level to more or less address the burden of emergency room visits. When you think of healthcare today, not everyone can go to a primary or whatnot, so they go to the emergency room.
Right.
And then what happens? You're there 5-6 hours, okay?
Well, it depends on where you're going.
True.
Look at Brockton in their situation, right? It's been exacerbated by
very
the Brockton
so.
Hospital fire, and all of that. Now all those patients have to go somewhere. Good Sam is having all kinds of crises because of it being under the under the stewardship of Stewart. Right, and then South Shore Hospital is also having to take on some of that as well, so it's tough.
And then don't forget Toby down in Wareham area,
yes.
And then in Plymouth we have Beth Israel. You know, so there's a lot of opportunities for us to address the needs of the community in this pilot program. It's a pilot program right now. Again, it's still on the drawing board, and we're trying to define partners and roles. And again, it'll be advertised for procurement. But in essence, what we're trying to do is eliminate that wait time, but also address the less emergency-based healthcare needs of the community. So instead of going to the emergency room, we can bring the services of a doctor, an EMT, in an ambulance and address the issues. One of the major complications right now for hospitals, if they have someone that reports to the emergency room and is discharged within 24 hours and then returns within 24 hours, the Department of Health fines the institution for not triaging and forecasting what that patient's needs are. So they'll do an early discharge. And what they need to do is have us address the issues that are clogging the wait lines in treatment. Because if you get into a bed, there's not enough beds in the South Shore to address all of the needs in the current condition. So you see people actually being lined up outside of the rooms of the emergency room in the hallway. And so we're trying to ease that burden.
And how many communities are able to respond or will have this capability? Is there a number?
Well, right now, if we're successful with the pilot program, we're looking at three areas of the geography of the county, and it has to be in relationship to where the hospitals are.
Okay.
So that has yet to be figured out. That would be something that a procurement would bring the expertise of the folks that would answer the request for proposal.
All right. Again, if you're ever tuning in, we got a county update with Plymouth County Commissioner Greg Hanley joining us. I want to kind of talk a little bit about a sister county program with Ireland. It's funny, it was St. Patrick's Day yesterday. Talk to me a little bit about a blue-green economy and kelp farming, and maybe in exchange for solar farms, or wind farms.
Yeah, that's something that we started last year. We went over to the county of Donegal, and John Buckley, who's the Register of Deeds, Bob Creedon, who's the Clerk of Courts, and young Jack Lally, City Council President at the time, with a delegation that went over to sign a counter agreement with the County of Donegal for a sister program, which consists of four conferences, two here in our country and two in their country. The first program was this past October. We had the Blue-Green Economy in the 1620 Hotel, and the County of Donegal brought a kelp farming operation in to address folks that are in the Duxbury, Kingston, Plymouth Basin, which are the conditions that are just ripe for this type of industry to come to town. And so kelp farming, and if you're familiar with the history of the Irish Trail, the mossing of seaweed, it was a major industry in Scituate And it's actually a Moss museum that's down there. So they got to address that with a gentleman that provides fertilization through kelp farming. And what it is, it's a green technology where they harvest the kelp. They then dehydrate it, they package it, and they send it to golf courses. What happens is the golf course receives it, spreads it out across their whole golf course. They water it. The water is then absorbed by the kelp, and then over time, the sun will then beat down on the kelp, and it'll release the moisture, and then it'll biodegrade into fertilizer. It is the most enormous green technology I've seen ripe for investment. So part of what we're doing is economic development in investors on both sides of the ocean to either economy. So that is the main principle is economic development. And with Plymouth being a tourism capital for this side of the U.S. with the pilgrims and everything that's going on over there, tourism in the counterpart over in Donegal is the old town Donegal where they have a castle. So exchanges of information on tourism, and then the last thing is culture. The Irish Riviera is here in this side of Massachusetts. The highest density of Irish immigrants in the country are in Plymouth County.
Okay.
And the highest density of population within Plymouth County is Scituate. So we hosted our friends from Ireland in a welcome dinner at the Hibernian Tavern where we had Irish step dances, Irish music, and Irish fare. And we received the mayor of Donegal, the economic minister, and one of the directors of the county. And we hosted the conference, and it was a great success. And we're looking forward to future things we can do, such as Plymouth County Wind, but we can talk about it another time.
Yeah, and just a quick honorable mention. I don't know if you at which parade you may have attended or if you didn't attend one of them, but actually I had a relative who actually won Mayor of Scituate. A tip of the cap to Adam Barisano, who actually competed to be mayor for a day in Scituate.
So we actually hosted the Donegal delegation that was up in Boston, and we were at Nick Collins' breakfast, and then we went down to the Scituate parade and then ended at J.P. Ryan's in Abington to call that a trifecta on St. Patrick's Day. We made the rounds.
And J.P.'s also a staple in the town of Abington, so you can't forget that. Let's quickly turn our focus to seeking another term. Seeking your fourth term, is that correct?
Fourth term. This would be, right now I'm serving 12 years after this year.
Yeah.
So, you know, and in the last election, I thought I was going to actually hang it up until they gave me the gavel. And then came along APA. So when you look at the relevancy of county government, we alone were very successful in returning the respectability of county government to the people of Plymouth County. And this gave us another opportunity to prove ourselves. But the difference being this time, you know, the reimbursement program was what we did under CARES. So the towns would actually have to spend the money and then prove to us that the money was used for the right thing, and we would reimburse them. This time around, it was a little bit different. The U.S. Treasury sets the rules on what we have to do. So we went out and procured the services of three important entities, one being a legal team, which is Mintz Levin. We have an auditing team, which is Powers and Sullivan. And we have Clifton Larson, and they are our accountants. So there are 27 tranches of money that a community would go out by community standards and define what is the use that they want to use this money for. Some of it is for capital projects, others for programming, but the best use of money so far has been those one-time cost projects that are in a community. A water, sewer, and broadband are the three primary tranches of monies that the most communities are going for, which is the best use of the funds. Because what does that do? It means you're reducing the cost of the town or the municipality to construct whatever project they're doing without having to go out and borrow. And if when you do have to go out and borrow, that means it's on the backs of the taxpayer. So if you look at the money that's being utilized, and I will say that Plymouth County offers counseling to cities and towns on the best use of monies. But what happens is out of those 27 tranches, they submit an application. Those three professional entities review it for legality purposes and use purposes that comply with the APRA law. And so with that, it comes out And the reason for that, Kevin, is the fact that after the money's been used, and I told you about that two-year period where we have to monitor the use of it, you don't want a community having to claw back, or the government have to claw back for a program that wasn't in the legislation. So it's very important. We had zero clawback under CARES, and we've been able to share our experience with the other four counties. And I can just say this region of Massachusetts is well represented by those counties, and we are delivering the goods for definitely the rest of the population.
So you're saying, so what's the motivating factor for the fourth term? Is it just to kind of continue on the mission of showing that county government is viable?
100%. So my goal going into the last term is to continue the program of APA. So I signed on, you know, but there is, if I were to leave now, then the idea of monitoring the uses, I would feel obligated if something were to go awry. So I want to finish that. With respect to the future of the county, once CARES and APA is over, what's next for Plymouth County government? If it's the legislation doesn't pass, how are we going to self-sustain? So we look at revenue-generating programs, like integrated health. If it passes the blue, the testing, we will make that a permanent program on the integrated mobile health. Plymouth County Wind is an opportunity, and we've just recently been approached to cap the transfer station in Plymouth behind the police station. That was something that we had in place but got tangled in a lawsuit that we are going to revisit. So those would be the three items that I would work on for revenue generation to help sustain, because it would be tipping fees on the trash. You'd get a clean landfill, but again, on the drawing board, and something that we would work on in the next term.
Do you have anything set up if folks want to get involved in your campaign early?
You know what, Kev? I was a lineman by trade. I block and tackle. I really have a hard time asking people to, you know, support me financially or otherwise. If you know, we come and we get this opportunity to speak to you and talk about what we do, I'd rather have, you know, the sweat talk than anything. But I appreciate anyone's opportunity who wants to come and vote for us on primary day.
And it's worth noting that all games are won in the trenches. And gentleman we have here, obviously, already just admitted, he goes, hey, that's where it happens, blocking and tackling. I'm in the trenches. And best of luck to you. Let's try to have you back in so you can have a fuller conversation about your reelection campaign. Because we spent more on the update, and it was a fantastic update, so thank you for your time.
And thank you, Kevin. I have to say that anytime I get invited, I know I'm going to be treated fairly and with respect, and vice versa. I offer you that respect back. And you know, I want to be the guy that's on the next commercial that says, that Kevin Tocci, he's a hell of a guy. Can you get that on tape so you can do that in your next promo?
I think you just did.
Thank you, sir.
I think you just did. There he is, Greg Hanley, Plymouth County Commissioner, joining us. Thank you again, sir. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, I promise you, more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Eat, drink, and socialize at the Patio at McWiggins in Whitman Center. Sit down with a specialty cocktail and start your meal off with a patio sampler with chicken wings, egg rolls, potato skins, fried cauliflower, and chicken and biscuits. Watch the game on 7 55-inch monitors while digging into braised short ribs, fish tacos, pig and goat cheese flatbread, or Koji steak tips. Relax and listen to the live entertainment at the patio every Friday and Saturday night. And don't forget, McWiggins Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tocci, on 95.9 WATD.
And we're back here on 95.9 WATD, and we move on to our State House report. It's fast and furious this evening. Joining us right now, she represents the Plymouth and Barnstable District. We have State Senator Sue Moran joining us. Senator, how are you?
Hi, Kevin. Real good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I hope you had a safe and wonderful St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, absolutely. I've always appreciated the luck of the Irish.
So I'm looking forward to our conversation, because I know that there was something that was voted on last week by the State Senate. And I know it's a piece of legislation that's near and dear to your heart, that is regarding child care. And this is an Early Ed Act to, you know, be able to help folks who need assistance when it comes to child care, when they need to go to work. And we know that the cost of putting a child in daycare is through the roof. It's quite costly. If you could kind of just kind of walk folks through, what was the origin of this particular piece of legislation? Because I know that it was something that was filed last year, but it was last session, 2021-2022, but wasn't successful.
Sure. This is transformational legislation, Kevin. And as much as I appreciate as a mom and a grandmother, making sure that the next generation has early professional eyes on them so that they can be as healthy and productive as they possibly can. We know America likes to lead, and particularly Massachusetts likes to lead. This bill not only is a child pro-health bill, it is an economic bill. It really promotes access to high-quality education from age zero and provides opportunities for families to be able to afford to take care of their children while they work, so that that is a real influx into our economy of folks who are able to not only help their families by working, but help the economy. And it also takes care of the child care system so that people that are in the child care business will be able to grow, so that individuals who work in the child care business will be able to really continue to get certifications and licenses for their professional development. And the great thing is that it was improved even from the original bill that was filed. Senator Lewis has been leading an incredible committee that was put together by the Senate President Karen Spilka and Mike Roderick's, the chair of Ways and Means. And I served on that committee, and it included so many experts in the field and advocates, people who take care of children, and healthcare providers and medical providers who know what children need from very early on, so that we can lower healthcare costs and education specialty costs in the future.
So it appears as though last Thursday this particular measure passed unanimously in the Senate. What's your thoughts as your colleagues voting for this, being unwavering when it comes to passing this bill?
Well, there are a lot of, senators are people too, right? A lot of family members have firsthand experience on how difficult it is to juggle child rearing along with your job. And even, individuals who are grandparents who may not have children really appreciate the shot in the arm to the economy that this bill represents. When we look at how expensive child care is, it's, the numbers liken it to the same as college tuition, which we know has skyrocketed before the current educational bill was moved forward. But this will really help families that qualify so that they can maybe afford their mortgage, maybe afford to own a home because they're getting help with their child care. It's part of a $1 billion tax relief package. It covers children under 13 and also, important to note, people with disabilities and senior dependents age 65 and older. You may be taking care, maybe intergenerational families where you have a person with disability or senior dependent that is in the home. And the estimates are that it's going to help about 570,000 families.
So I'm going to ask you the taxpayer question, and that is, what is the cost going to be? Is this going to be an annual cost of dot, dot, dot?
Well, yes, which always depends on our ability to fund the budget. One of the things, it does eliminate a cap, And so it's going to, right now, with the current benefit to families might be $180, it's going to bring that to $440 for qualifying families. And it really is a, right now, a significant funding allocation in the our fiscal 24 budget. It's going to be $714 million for children involved with the Department of Child and Families or Department of Transitional Assistance, and then $475 million for the Commonwealth Cares for Children, or C3 grants, which is going to be something that's, it's been a crucial lifeline, but that's going to be something that stays. And then it's going to add $85 million rate increases for subsidized child care providers and $20 million for child care resource and referral agencies. So it's going to make those C3 grants permanent, so the child care businesses won't have to wonder if they can afford to stay open year after year. They're going to be able to plan like a regular business moves forward. And then, you know, when we look at goals into the future, we're not sure what the budget is going to entail. We know that the budget has gone down more recently after the post-COVID ARPA funding has ended. And so when we're in transitional period, other numbers are going to go up and down. And so we're looking at other creative ways to boost the system. One great example is, you know, our business community. If you're a major employer, say, for example, a hospital, there are going to be opportunities to partner so that there can be support for child care systems where people work, especially larger employers such as hospitals.
So would this be, depending on someone's median income, would it be like a sliding scale as to how much families would be eligible for?
Well, right now it's going to improve affordability. Okay. It's going to expand eligibility for families that are making up right now 85% of the state median income, which is about $124,000 for a family of four.
Okay.
But it really paves the way for expanding the subsidy program for families making up to 125 of SMI, which would bring it up to 182,000. And that has been something that I've been really driving forward, because I think that, you know, lower income families, you know, Massachusetts has a tradition of helping and being sure that that generation of children is really healthy. And we know that if we don't address healthcare costs and educational challenges early, it only costs us more. But this has the potential of moving this assistance and the system of boosting child care right up to the middle income families, which we know during COVID got kicked in the gut, particularly women that had to get off their career path, had to maybe stay home because of, you know, hybrid learning, for example. And now we know that kids are challenged with mental health issues because they've spent, you know, basically years in one kind of isolation or another, masking otherwise. And so what the bill really lays the path for is to really boosting up those higher income families as well, so that Massachusetts can get back to the competitive, really, you know, path that we're used to. We want to lead the country, and we have a whole set of workforce families that are ready to go if they can focus on work instead of worrying about kids day to day.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Senator Sue Moran, and she's talking to us about this Early Ed Act legislation that passed the Senate last Thursday. And if I'm correct as far as its trajectory, Senator, heading over to the House, what does your intel tell you? Is this something that is going to be welcomed by the House, or do you expect any kind of changes to this legislation, which would mean that it would have to go to a conference committee?
Well, you know, I think that this is ready to go. Senator Lewis and Representative Peisch led sort of a bicameral and bipartisan committee that heard from all the experts. I think this is a bill that is really ready to move forward. The Early Ed Act has a lot of fans in the House, in addition to having been passed already by the Senate. I look forward to any new ideas that the House may propose. But, you know, when you look at the sort of, you know, trifecta approach, this not only helps families and helps teachers, but it really also helps the child care businesses that are existing. And folks that are more on the conservative side, I think, will appreciate that it proposes an increase in the maximum number of children that can be served by larger family child care programs, because it looks at, you know, updates that have occurred professionally, whether states such as New York, California, Illinois, and Maryland. But it doesn't, you know, the legislation itself doesn't make requirements in that regard. It lets the professionals who are in the child care administration set those guidelines. So it really points to some economical tweaks that can be made to existing child care, and looks at shared service hubs. It looks at really modernizing the system and looking at the current cost-sharing fee scale to be updated now and then every 5 years. So lots of modernization going on that the House can look at as well.
And I think I want to close out by letting you talk a little bit about a piece of legislation I believe that you signed on to, co-sponsored, and that is the Revenge Porn Bill.
Oh, yes, and that's something, you know, that has been really hard pushed by advocates since even the Baker administration. And it's a House-approved bill that cracks down on revenge porn. Senate 2703, if people want to look it up, would criminalize sharing sexually explicit images or video of someone without their consent. And there really have been a lot of victims that have come to the State House. I've met with them. And we look forward to having a bill proceed. It's going to increase fines for criminal harassment from $1,000 to $5,000. And we think it's really going to publicize the fact that victims have a place to go to really get their rights restored, and that perpetrators would think twice because the punishment has even been increased.
As we get ready to wrap up here, anything you want to touch upon in regards in district, or if folks wanted to touch base with you during your office hours in district?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I know you've been seeing a lot in the news is the decommissioning of the Holtec plant, and I really appreciate the advocates that have continued to work with me for the last several years, and really want to applaud the several measures that we've been able to uncover as of late, and to really get the federal government along with the state to partner with, being sure that, you know, decommissioning funds are spent appropriately, that there is no evaporation that is not permitted. Really just public health and, you know, economic guidelines that need to be followed. So appreciate everyone that's been working on that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see if we can maybe have you back on in a couple of months to talk about the budget, because I know that as soon as the House is finished with their version, it'll head right over to you. I believe last I knew it was going to be, early to mid-April for the House to tackle the budget. Any thoughts, early thoughts on the fiscal 25 budget as it's being prepared?
Well, you know, I think that the balance of competitiveness, being sure that taxpayers aren't let's just say taxed in a sense when they're just trying to get back on their feet. You're going to be, I think, able to report on lots of conversation going back and forth as senators and reps really try to protect their districts but move forward with services that are key and important to people.
Senator, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for chatting with us about this piece of legislation in regards to child care. I know it's something that it's on a lot of people's minds, especially the younger folks who, you know, are maybe they're just getting out of college and they're trying to plan a family, or maybe they've already started a family, and it's a matter of, like, we want to be able to, you know, further ourselves and not necessarily go into debt, just trying to, you know, go to work and have child care to be able to, you know, take care of our child until they're able to go to school.
Right on, Kevin. Exactly right.
You got it. All right. This year's State Senator Sue Moran has been our guest for this segment of Monday Night Talk. And just so you know, coming up right after the top of the hour CBS News, we have Chris DiIorio. He is Monday Night Talk's legal analyst. I was going to say WATD. I mean, it is one and the same, but Monday Night Talk's legal analyst talking a little bit about the Karen Reed case. How many of you have been following along and kind of wondering certain things? That's me. And who do I tap? A guy who kind of follows these things, like a Chris DiIorio. Chris is going to be joining us in a few moments. And then if you're curious about how we're going to solve some of the environmental issues that we have, solving the climate crisis, because it's all part of the environment, looking to talk to Dr. John Berger, author of the book Solving the Climate Process. That's all coming up in just a few moments. Stay tuned. More Monday Night Talk coming up.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
We return for more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Again, later this hour, Dr. John Berger, author of Solving the Climate Crisis. But right now, we have a chance to speak with Mr. Chris DiIorio. He is Monday Night Talk's legal expert. That's what I've coined him. Defense attorney, plus also an avid marathon runner. We'll get to that later on in the segment as well. Mr. DiIorio, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir. And again, we're waiting to speak to Mr. Chris DiIorio. Do we have Chris there?
Chris, do you?
Hey, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. How are you?
I'm doing well, doing well. Everything hurts. You know, I've been doing a lot of running, obviously, but doing well.
So let's talk a little bit about the Karen Reed murder case. I'm just curious as to if you have been following this ongoing saga. For the folks who are tuning in and maybe you're new to this particular thing, prosecutors have alleged that Reed backed over her boyfriend, Officer John O'Keefe, and left him to die in a January 2022 blizzard in Canton. She is charged with second-degree murder, motor vehicle manslaughter, and leaving the scene of a collision in connection with his death. Your thoughts, Chris?
Well, then, I think that where we are with the case right now is very intriguing. Both the prosecution and the defense are locked in a struggle over evidence right now, and cases will rise and fall on the perception of that evidence. Sometimes you can have great evidence, but it also depends on how it's perceived. And right now, the defense is sort of taking the lead in this, in trying to get certain pieces of evidence to be allowed in, that being, you know, phone records from alleged witnesses or other actors in the case, and trying to get that evidence to come in, while also trying to exclude other types of evidence dealing with local state police investigators that have been involved in the case. So they're, you know, the defense is sort of taking the lead on evidence and shaping how that evidence is going to be perceived. And the Norfolk County prosecutors are back on their heels a little bit. They don't like to lose. You know, prosecutors, you know, they don't like to lose. And right now, the defense is putting them through their paces, is what we would say.
So I need to ask you about your opinion regarding the indictment of Turtle Boy blogger Aidan Kearney, who's actually facing 16 charges. Will that have any impact on the Reed case or the defense team's work to find her innocent?
It has had a great deal of effect thus far. When you have someone with his reach, and I'm no fan. Turtle Boy has done a number on more than a few people that I call good friends. But you can't deny the reach. And for him to have, you know, to start down this path, to be connected with her attorneys and doing the work that he's been doing up until the past few months or so after he's, you know, been indicted. But you know, you've got a billboard outside of Gillette Stadium saying "Free Karen Reed." You've got multiple Facebook groups, a legal fund online that's raised upwards of $300,000 for her legal expenses, and a lot of that comes from his, you know, championing of her version of events here at, well, her version slash the version that her attorneys are putting out into the world. And, you know, the trial by media strategy, you know, while the prosecutors may not like it, it works. Mm. It does work. And it may, in fact, work in this case.
Is it going to make it ultimately tough on the prosecution to find a you know, folks who are going to sit in the jury and be willing to listen without feeling as though they have been swayed by the public propaganda?
Yeah, it's part of the reason why, you know, that they put these statements out there, and it's not just the defense in this case. I mean, the prosecution will, you know, for every story you see that comes out from Dave Unetti and Alan Jackson, the two attorneys representing Karen Reed, you're going to see at least two more come out, you know, that are pro-prosecution. They know how to play the game as well. And part of what you do in large cases like this is you want to put seeds in the heads of potential jurors. Just recently with the Michael Chesna and Vera Adams case, also, you know, coming out of Norfolk County, this, because you couldn't find people in the jury pool that hadn't heard something about it or hadn't been influenced by it, you then wind up having to pull jurors in from other counties to sit in you know, to sit in judgment on this case. That may well be what Judge Canone has to do, and she was the judge on the Gomes case as well. So it very well may be that at some point the prosecution may go to her and say it's impossible for us to get a fair trial based on the publicity. The Boston Globe has reach. You know, the larger statewide newspapers have reach. The stuff gets out there, and we may well find it down the road a couple of months from now where they're going to have to petition to have jurors brought in from Worcester County or from Essex County or something that where they don't have or haven't had the mass exposure on a regular basis as this case is generated on a seemingly every week something new comes out, especially now that we're ramping up towards trial.
He's just tuning in. We are speaking with a legal expert, defense attorney, Chris DiIorio, talking a little bit about the Karen Reed murder case as it's ongoing. A couple of new developments that I think you kind of might have alluded to it earlier on in the conversation here. The first, of course, is an accident reconstructionist has been hired by the FBI, and they found that O'Keefe's injuries did not appear to be from a car strike. The defense team has asked for the case to be dismissed on this evidence. Is this enough information to be able to ask this of the judge?
It's certainly enough to file the motion, but as far as the likelihood of its success, and this is a question of fact, and questions of fact along with the jury. Cases don't get dismissed by judges on motions to dismiss unless the facts are undeniable. And while the defense has this these accident reconstruction information from the federal investigators, you know, the prosecution has their own information regarding the broken taillight and the hair that still we don't have a result on DNA strands that allegedly there was hair found in the bumper or the broken taillight of the car, and they're trying to say that in fact matched him, which would then lead to believe that he might have been hit by the car. So when there are questions of fact, those belong in the province of the jury and not necessarily with the judge, unless the facts can't be seen any other way. This creates, however, as far as a factual question for a jury, this is what defense attorneys live for. This is reasonable doubt. The idea, when I teach kids about this stuff, when I teach college students about this stuff, I tell them that it's not the job for the defense to say that the person is innocent. You simply have to say that they're not guilty. And not guilty means the prosecution can't meet their burden of proof. They have to prove that she did these things beyond a reasonable doubt. And reasonable doubt is where defense attorneys live. If you can put things in front of a jury that make them question whether, in fact, the evidence is such that the prosecution has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt, if you can create doubt, that's what that gets you not guilty. At the very least, it gets you mistrials. Similar to what happened, as I said, with the Gomes case and the Chesna and Vera Adams situation, you want to look for something where you put doubt in at least one juror's mind, and that's all it takes to get a mistrial. You need a unanimous verdict in any criminal case. You've got to get 12 people in the box to say, yes, she did it. And if you can get one or two or three voices in the room that will say, I have questions.
Is it an art form to find that, when you're picking your jury, when you're up there and you're questioning them to try to find your one Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men, the person who's going to listen and go, you're going to pique their interest enough to go, well, some of this doesn't add up, and have the ability to be able to kind of share that information and maybe encourage the other jurors to kind of look at it as well.
Jury selection consultancy is a multi-million dollar business, and don't think for a moment that there aren't, focus groups and jury panels that will be assembled with, folks from the outside, and they will go in and present arguments to these folks and see what works. And that then helps you see what kind of jurors you want to be looking for in your particular case, once you know what arguments might play and what might not. But over the course of a career, you learn, when you're looking at a jury questionnaire and when you're asking questions of a juror, what type of person you're looking for and what type of person you definitely don't want. It's not always who you would expect, but it does come with experience to know that this person who fills out their jury questionnaire and doesn't put anything down that might be potentially something that you might be able to question them about further. That's someone who always scares me. That's someone who seems to me to be trying to get on the jury for a particular reason, and that might not necessarily always be in the defense favor. But there are other things that you look for on the questionnaire that might lead you to go towards them. But ultimately, it's a lot of if you get a chance to talk to them, if you get a chance to hear their answers to questions, it's as much a science as it is an art. To be able to know what you're looking for, and it comes with experience.
And going back, talking about new developments in this case, also there's a probe into one of the state police's lead investigators. How is this going to play a role in the case moving forward, how's defense utilizing this, and what does the prosecution do in regards to this new information?
It might not seem like much. I mean, what they're talking about with the state police investigator is he initially said he didn't have any knowledge of who these people were and had no connection to them. And then it comes out that not only did he know who they were, that he was actually, had enough faith in one of the women who it might be an actor, not like a performer, but a person who has a position in this case, and was going to use her as a babysitter for his kids. So there was a connection. It might not seem like a whole lot, But it is. When you have someone who's being trusted to do expert investigation on a case who has a potential bias in that case, now what the defense says is anything that this person brought forth as potential evidence now has to be either excluded. You know, you file a motion to suppress, and any pieces of evidence that came out through the state police investigator that this person either had their hands on directly or they were proximately related to it. Anything that comes from the state police may now come, you know, it may now be suppressed. And it could be, you know, important pieces of evidence that the prosecution needs. The prosecution really hasn't said anything about this yet. They haven't made any, you know, statements other than we trust our investigators and we trust that they're going to be, you know, professional. But ultimately what you're saying is that this information may have been withheld. It certainly was withheld from the grand jury when they decided to indict. And if they perhaps if they had knowledge that this investigator was, you know, connected to these folks that might may or may not be involved in the case at a base level, then perhaps they look at that evidence differently. It's tremendously important. You know, and like I said, and it goes back to what I said previously. It's doubt. You're sowing the seeds of doubt. And if things like even if this evidence comes in, now the defense has something to say when this witness testifies, and everything, you know, the questioning about the, you know, it goes to bias, and it's you want to make sure if you're putting a witness on the stand that they come in clean. This witness is no longer clean, and you know, setting aside that you know this witness now is under investigation for something that the state police haven't said. You know, they're still on the job, they're still collecting a paycheck, which pretty much happens almost all the time because people under investigation shouldn't lose their jobs, apparently, as far if you're law enforcement. But this person is now under a separate investigation that may not even be related to this case. So now that's more fodder for the defense if this witness is going to testify in this case. And if they're involved in the collection of evidence, they're going to wind up testifying where this evidence is going to get tossed.
If we're looking at all this information, what we're, where we're at this particular time, and if you're keeping score before they even choose a trial date, who right now has the upper hand in this? Does the prosecution still hold all the cards, or is
always
okay? Or is the, or does the defense have any kind of? Do they have any chance as to with all the information they have to make this a winnable case?
When I say, oh, the prosecution has all the cards, they don't have all the cards, but they're always in control. You know, up to the time that you put a jury in the box, the prosecution has tremendous control over events. But once you put 12 in the box, then all bets are off. And now you've got all these questions related to evidence, they come in. Any bias, that comes in. If witnesses might have great information, but if they're not strong witnesses and if they have their own, you know, skeletons in their closet, that's when this stuff comes out. The defense has a case here. The defense can succeed. And if they keep getting wins in their column as far as evidence is concerned and as far as the public is concerned, then it becomes a greater likelihood that they, you know, can be successful at trial. But like I said, if the judge decides that they want to bring in jurors from Hampshire County, where it's unlikely they've heard the name Karen Reed, and they haven't driven past Foxborough and seen a giant free Karen Reed sign, and they don't get the Globe on a daily basis, and they don't check in, then it's possible that all of those things go out the window. But you've still got the question of bias. Any juror who's sitting there, and they hear one witness testify, and then the defense comes in on cross-examination and says, didn't you know this family before you started this investigation? Didn't you ask this woman to be your babysitter? And now the seeds have been planted right there with the jury, and there's nothing the prosecution can do about that once it's done.
Well, again, this is, you know, I want to continue this conversation with you as developments happen, as it moves forward. So you and I will keep an eye on this and have another conversation. But I want to turn my focus to you training for the 127th running of the Boston Marathon. As your training is starting to wind down, has the training become easier?
No, it hurts. It all hurts because as the more experience I have in doing these things, I'm also getting older. So you don't bounce back as fast. And the thing is, I know now, this will be my fifth marathon. This will be my fourth time running Boston for Mass General Hospital's Pediatric Cancer Clinic. I know now, having gone through it and followed this same training program, I know that if it hurts today, I know how long it should take me to get back to where I'm supposed to be. I know to trust the program. It gets easier mentally to know that, okay, I know that that's supposed to hurt, or to be able to tell the difference between it. My father, who, coached college athletics for, the better part of 30 plus years, always would say, when I'd say, I'd come to him with an injury, or one of his players would come to him, and he'd say, are you hurt or are you injured? Because if you're hurt, everybody hurts. There's the professionals hurt. The elite runners hurt. It may not seem like it, but they do have pain. Then people who run the marathon in 2 hours and 30 minutes, they're going through training and they hurt too. They're going home and icing down. They're doing all these things, but they know what to expect and they know how to treat their bodies to do it. And me as a 6 hour plus marathoner, I know that I'm going to be out there three times as long. So I know that I have, more to do to take care of myself, and I'm better at doing those things and not letting it get in my head that, oh God, that run absolutely sucked. And, how am I possibly going to finish this? I know that I've done it before, so I know where to put my head.
The one thing I have to say about you as a fundraiser, you are beyond creative with your ways to be able to stimulate donations. Yeah. Recently, you attempted to complete a tour of Italy for a fundraiser. God. Could you tell the fine folks at home what that involved?
Yeah, folks who know me know that I take my, I'm a big guy. I'm pushing three bills. So that's also one of the reasons why I run, is because when people look at me, they say, you run a marathon? Pull this other leg. But I am a foodie. I have, especially when it comes to Italian food, and because of that, I look at a place like the Olive Garden as being my version of Italian hell. This would be, like if there's a hell, it's going to be one of two places. It's going to be like they said in The Sopranos. It's going to be the Emerald Piper, and it's going to be an Irish bar where it's St. Patrick's Day every day. And, or it's going to be all the food is going to be catered by the Olive Garden. Because people know this, and a lot of my creative fundraising comes with people who like to torture me. 2 years ago, they know that I cannot stand Disney. I'm not a Disney person. And so I fundraised on Disney. This time I decided that I was going to raise money. And if people got me to a certain, my fundraising goal, my minimum is $7,500. So at the time I said, if I can get people to get me to $6,500, I will eat a full meal at the Olive Garden. I'll live stream it so you can watch that I did it. Whoever the top bidder is gets to choose my menu for me. Me having never been to the Olive Garden, I don't know what's on their menu, but I have seen it, and it looks exactly like I described. So people got me over that $6,500 line. And so last night I figured, why wouldn't I eat at the Olive Garden on a day designed to support the Irish? So I went on St. Patrick's Day last night to the Olive Garden in Stoughton, and I sat down with my friend Paul, who loves to torture me, who, last time out donated $250 to make me sing It's a Small World on the Small World ride in Disney. So he came there. He chose my menu for me. I live streamed the whole thing, and I had the tour of Italy, which if you're unfamiliar, which you should be, but if you're not, you have a little chunk of lasagna.
Yeah.
So I can really describe it as a chunk of lasagna, a lot of fettuccine Alfredo, which doesn't occur in Italy and also shouldn't occur in nature. and a little, hunk of chicken Parmesan. The whole thing is covered in what I'm pretty sure is cheese, although I'm not sure. And so I ate that online last night, and it was. I'm still suffering a little gastric distress today. I got to tell you, it was. I won't do it again unless I raise a lot more money.
Okay.
Because it was quite disturbing, and I brought the food. I brought the what survived. I brought it home for my son,
Peter, yeah.
Who's seven, and I said, Peter, here, I want you to try this. And Peter took a bite, and he said, "Oh, Dada, that's not real chicken." But a seven-year-old knew that that's not real chicken to him. He was pretty sure that the cheese sauce in the Alfredo was Elmer's glue, because it stuck to everything. So he was not impressed at seven. And if you can't impress a seven-year-old with gobs of cheese and sauce,
you're in trouble.
Well, you know, you're not impressive at all.
If folks, as we're wrapping up, and again, we're speaking with Chris DiOrio, we've transitioned from the legal expert to the marathon runner who's raising funds for the Mass General Hospital Pediatric Cancer Clinic. If folks want to be able to help you not endure such torture and donate to your cause, how can they do that, sir?
Well, if you go, the Marathon Boston Athletic Association has partnered with a website, a fundraising website called Give and Gain. It's G-I-V as in victory, E-N as in Nancy, Gain as in, you know, the detergent, G-A-I-N. If you go to giveandgain.com and just search my name, Chris DiOrio, or look for Mass General Hospital, you'll see a rather large, bald man hugging his children at the finish line from last year's marathon. But if you go to Give and Gain and search my name, you'll be able to donate there. You can find me on social media, my Facebook and Instagram page. Just look for Chris DiOrio and you'll find me. And all of my social media is covered with the fundraising platforms. And I'm raffling off pink tickets for when she comes to Gillette Stadium this coming August. I've got sweepstakes for two lower bowl seats for her. So that's another way that you can donate and get something out of the donation other than the goodness of feeling like you've done something for kids with cancer.
Well, again, thank you for your time, and I look forward to having you back on to continue our saga of Cameron Reed and your marathon runs.
Thank you for allowing me to speak with the Dean of South Shore Radio, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you. There he is, Chris DiOrio. We're going to step aside. More Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Adventure Car Hop is the place to go for food that's always right.
Way back before rock and roll was golden oldies, cars looked funny. They had protruding, bulbous buffons of chrome at the front and chandeliers hanging off the rear, and long enough to hold an entire hockey team with sticks, plus room in the trunk for a dentist chair. Back then, hockey players wore no masks and had no teeth. Remember the hockey sticks? High sticking occurs even in the team Oldsmobile, with results easily imagined.
Windshield broken? I'm Tiny of Tiny and Sons Glass. Yes, your insurance company will pay. 1-888-64-TINYS.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Hey, remember, if you miss any of our conversations, you just go to the podcast site. It's as easy as going to the homepage of WATD. You can do that. And click on podcasts. You'll see all the different shows. You'll see Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. Or you can search for us in Spotify. We're available in Spotify. And most of the podcasts are on Podbean. So, again, if you're looking for any of the conversations that we have, they are uploaded. And like I said, we have, I can't believe how many that we have uploaded over the past 12 years. And actually, it might be 13 years. I lose count. As we started back in 2010 with Bob Hedlund, doing it part-time here and there, and he slowly phased out, and we took over the program. Quick note also that this radio show is generously sponsored by Tiny and Sons Glass. Peter does a great job. Peter Brown, Eddie, Deanne, and the whole gang over there, as Tiny would say, his boys do good. And also McGuigan's Pub and The Patio. Those are some of our sponsors. Big thumbs up to Richard Rosen. I'm sure that things went well during St. Patrick's Day. So, again, thank you to the supporters. So right now we turn our attention to our final guest of the evening. He's the author of Solving the Climate Crisis. He is John Berger. I think it's Dr. John Berger. John, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you very much, Kevin. How are you tonight?
Now, do you prefer Doctor or do you prefer John?
I'm okay with Dr. John J. Berger.
Okay, so I just want to make sure. I know the PhD was on the end, but in a lot of your press clippings here, it just cites you as John. So I want to make sure I was doing right by you. Welcome to the show. I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about the book. Now, you're not new to writing. You have written and edited 11 books. How different was this book compared to your previous works?
Well, I think this was a little bit more ambitious because it covers the entire spectrum of everything that we need to do in order to solve the climate crisis. It approaches it holistically or in a comprehensive way, and it looks at the kinds of solutions that we need to have in technology and in ecology and also in the socioeconomic, cultural, political dimension.
Now, what did it take for you to be able to put this book together? Because it sounds to me like you probably had to spend a lot of time, do a lot of traveling to be able to do some research to kind of put all of those copious notes into a book like this.
No, it's funny because in retrospect, you're absolutely right. It took me 8 years of work, and that's not counting the years that led up to actually starting this particular book. I did travel throughout Western Europe and throughout the United States, and I spoke to hundreds of people all the way from farmers to energy secretaries. And so it took a lot of time, and there were lots of loose ends to tie up and something like 700 footnotes to write.
So how did you get Senator Feingold to do the introduction for your book?
Well, I was brash. I just wrote to the senator, and by being persistent, I got through. And, of course, I had written to other people as well, and there were many no's on the road to yes.
So this sounds, I mean, if we're going to solve the climate crisis, it's almost as though we're going to need to have everybody kind of, you know, working together. We're talking, I don't know how many countries we have now on the globe, 108, 109, 120, but everybody?
About 195 countries globally.
Okay. How are we going to get 195 countries to kind of buy in to preserve our children's future? Would you say that your book kind of helps push us in that direction?
Well, goodness gracious, I would hope it does, but what can one person do? There are examples where a committed individual has gotten disproportionate results, and I always try to be that one exception. But when you speak of 195 countries around the world, I think I go along with what Saul Alinsky, the organizer, once said, start where you stand. And I think the very first thing for us to do is to work on the United States. And currently, we are the world's largest oil producer, largest oil consumer, largest natural gas producer, largest natural gas consumer, third largest producer of coal. And so we're exporting climate change, and we're also accelerating it by what we're doing here. You made an allusion to the idea that this is an all-hands-on-deck problem and that we really need to mobilize the entire nation and make this a number one priority. It's hard for people to see it that way because it's a looming catastrophe just over the horizon, even though we're getting intimations of it and having to deal with all kinds of mega floods and mega droughts and bomb cyclones of hurricanes and weather events and deviations of the what am I trying to say? Not the Gulf Stream, but the atmospheric circulation around the polar circulation of the atmosphere, which usually keeps the cold in at the Arctic, and now that's begun to wobble and waver and let aberrant weather into the Midwestern part of the United States during the winter. Anyway, so it's a very, very serious disruption of the climate that we're encountering. And my contention is that we have to have a declaration of a national climate emergency, which will help mobilize the country, because I believe we need the same kind of national mobilization that we had during World War II, when we had to gear up from a peacetime to a wartime economy and to do it very quickly. But we showed that we had the capability of doing it and going from a standing start to producing millions of weapons and untold numbers of aircraft and jeeps and amphibious craft, et cetera. So I think, to back up for a minute, the message of my book, if you will, Kevin, is that we have all the technology that we need today, maybe 98% of it, to profitably solve this ever-worsening climate crisis, and to do it, moreover, in a way that unlocks trillions of dollars in savings and actually creates millions of new good-paying jobs and literally saves millions of lives globally while we protect public health and our democracy and the environment. So that's the good news. We can do this. We not only have all the technology, but we also have the financial strength as the wealthiest nation on Earth. So we should demonstrate that we can get our own house in order and convert the U.S. economy entirely to reliance on clean, sustainable energy. Then we can go around the world proselytizing, and there are all kinds of things that we could do diplomatically to help spur the rest of the nations of the world, some of whom are quite a bit ahead of us, incidentally, on this trajectory.
All right, so let's talk about cleaning up our own house here. In your book, I believe that you state that America, we waste between 30 and 50% of the energy that is used in buildings today. Waste, I mean, if we learn not to waste, is it possible to fix this?
You bet it is. And the problem is, in the building sector, it's twofold. There are existing buildings, about 110 million of them, and then there are new buildings. The new buildings are a lot easier to deal with because you just adopt stringent building codes that require the building to be as energy efficient as possible, use all cost-effective means to do so. You would also insist that the buildings be reliant on clean, renewable power sources to the extent that they are able to generate it on the rooftop. That should be required, but to the extent that large buildings need auxiliary power inputs, that should come from clean power sources, from wind farms and from solar power sources, geothermal power. And these new buildings also should make use of geothermal heat pumps. All of these new technologies are probably four times as efficient as any combustion technology you could use in the building that involved natural gas heating, for example, in contrast to the geothermal heat pump that I just mentioned. Renewable energy is not combustion energy, so you're not losing waste heat to any appreciable degree, as you do when you burn a fossil fuel like oil or coal or natural gas, and some two-thirds of the energy is lost as heat when you convert to electricity. And the exact percentage varies on the based on the technology that you're using. So anyway, back to buildings. And older buildings are a bigger challenge for us.
Right.
But they are a huge opportunity, because fixing these buildings is a job that cannot be outsourced to, you know, to countries where wages are lower. And if we have a national campaign targeting the retrofitting or refurbishing of buildings, that will be a source of millions of new jobs in installation of clean energy technology, in construction, and also in operation and maintenance, and in supply chain jobs. So we'll need to be retrofitting these existing buildings with better insulation, with energy efficient windows, with new appliances, for example, electric cooktops instead of gas ranges. The buildings will have solar panels. They'll have modern space conditioning equipment that will use heat pumps instead of combustion. And this kind of program, as I mentioned, will be very good for the economy. And it can be encouraged with federal tax credits and loans and grants and all kinds of clever financing methods that I talk about in my book, Solving the Climate Crisis. The other thing that is important to note is that the whole clean energy transition is far too important to be left to kind of haphazard decision making and everybody going their own way in states and cities and towns. We need a national clean energy action plan, or national climate action plan, that will set national goals and milestones and monitor progress and readjust goals if we're not meeting them, so that we can really accelerate our transition toward the clean energy economy that we want.
John, do you think that that's something that should be a priority? We got a presidential election that's coming up. Do you feel that that's something that should be paramount for the two candidates who are running to be the next president for the next 4 years to put together a national climate plan?
I think it should be, and I don't see how anybody could be opposed to it, because today in the United States, we're actually spending in the aggregate about $1 trillion on fossil fuels. And that's money that we're actually, you know, setting on fire, as Bill McKibben likes to say. We're spending $560 billion per year on oil and $392 billion per year for natural gas and $50 billion on coal. And if we convert our economy to rely on clean electricity and we electrify absolutely everything that can be electrified, as I mentioned, the electrical technology is more efficient than combustion technology. Then once we have a clean economy, we can use the money that we were burning every year, we can use that to power our economy and to provide new jobs and to meet social needs that are being unmet. And when I talk about the costs in terms of the $1 trillion for fossil fuel, that doesn't include the hundreds of billions or maybe $1 trillion in damages that are caused to the nation and to the atmosphere, to the environment, to public health. Not many people seem to understand that air pollution, it's caused 90% by fossil fuel burning. And globally, it costs 7.5 to 8 million lives every year as a result of health problems and premature deaths that result from breathing air pollution. So if you want to put a dollar figure on that, it's enormous. And we're wasting money and causing problems in many other ways as well. So it's urgent from an economic standpoint, as well as from a public health and climate standpoint, that we accelerate the move to a clean energy economy.
And, you know, you talking about, I mentioned, you know, the presidential, I mean, let's talk about other policymakers in Congress. I mean, how important is it for folks to elect people who are willing to make, you know, a national climate plan part of their platforms? But what can individuals also do for the betterment of the climate?
I'm so glad that you raised those questions because they are fundamental questions and they're large questions. I don't know how much time you're gonna keep me on the air.
Another 15 minutes.
Okay. Well, I think it's simpler for me to explain what an individual can do and then try and talk about the policy questions afterwards. As individuals, we can only do so much. We can put a drop in the bucket. We should put a drop in the right bucket when it comes to our personal decision making. And yes, we should recycle. Yes, we should use smaller, more energy efficient vehicles, electric vehicles if possible, walk, ride bikes, and so forth. We should be conserving of energy and not waste food. But all of these things that individuals do, they're helpful when aggregated, but we're dealing with systemic problems that require systemic solutions, and the solutions have to come from the top down as well as bubble up from the bottom. When I say bubble up, I mean that ordinary individuals have to coalesce and organize to try to make sure that the right policies are implemented and to hold their representatives accountable and bird dog those representatives and insist that they make public stands on their climate policies and then hold them accountable for that. So that said, individuals have small symbolic choices that they can make, not wasting, carrying, let's say, a cloth bag to the grocery store. But when they make major decisions like what type of a heating system to put in the house or what type of a refrigerator to have or a washer dryer or a dishwasher, these are more consequential decisions for major appliances, and those should be made very carefully to try and get the most energy efficient appliance possible, which will have the least environmental impact through its energy demand. Okay, so in terms of other major personal decisions, when you buy a car, for example, which is going to be consuming energy for 10 to 20 years while it's on the road, I know the average is about 12 years, but still we have many old cars on the road. If they're energy efficient, then that's optimal. And if they're powered electrically, then ultimately, as we move to 100% clean energy supplied grid, those vehicles will also be clean vehicles, not just clean at the tailpipe, but also clean in terms of their demand on the electrical power system. We want to phase out all natural gas and all coal power burning, all power plants that burn coal and that burn natural gas in favor of reliance on solar power plants, photovoltaic power plants, solar thermoelectric power plants, and wind power plants, both onshore and offshore, geothermal energy for heat and also for power. Ultimately, a certain amount of power will come from wave energy as well. But we have all of the energy resources, far more in terms of resources than we demand to meet our energy needs in the United States. Renewable energy is vast in vast supply, and it's also eternal and fuel-free. In terms of policies that elected officials ought to be implementing, I think that domestically we need a national clean energy bank to focus on providing adequate funding for a rapid clean energy transition and to provide many low-interest loans and grants and so forth to fund the transition. It would be a good idea to also have new clean energy treasury bonds. And in terms of regulation, in the power sector now, we have a number of states, I think 19, if I'm not mistaken, that demand that the power sector, meaning the utility sector, steadily increase its adoption of clean energy technology and accelerate its phase out of fossil fuels, namely oil, coal, and natural gas. So I think, along with Mark Jacobson, a scientist and professor of engineering and atmospheric studies at Stanford University, we need these renewable portfolio standards in other sectors of the economy, so that, just I had mentioned, we have a big backlog of energy inefficient buildings, so we have a huge backlog of work to be done in the transportation sector to electrify it, and also in industry. So I'm saying that as part of a national climate action plan, we ought to have sort of pace-setting regulatory forcing that accelerates the transition in every sector of the economy. We should, as well as a national climate action plan, have a national carbon fee and dividend plan. This would help to internalize some of the external costs in the form of air pollution and public health damages that are now caused by the fossil fuel industry, and incorporate those, in other words, internalize them into the costs of fossil fuel. This would make fossil fuel less competitive than it is today, and therefore it would channel market forces to begin to accelerate the transition to clean energy sources as opposed to relying on fossil fuels. That's one thing that, could be done domestically. We also need a lot better regulation of the banking industry to prevent further expansion of new fossil fuel developments, which have a very protracted lifespan, and therefore, if you start building new fossil fuel facilities and power plants today, they are going to be creating emissions 30 years from now,
right.
and we don't want that.
Right.
In addition, we ought to also stop subsidizing fossil fuels. It's like we're funding what we don't want, and instead we ought to be subsidizing renewables even more so than today, although they're very competitive,
right,
and are cheaper for new power generation than new coal or new natural gas. But in the United States, we're providing about $646 billion a year in implicit and explicit subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. Why on earth we are coddling and sponsoring and subsidizing a wealthy, mature industry that is causing untold harm and imposing costs on households and on the environment, it's beyond me.
I'm right there with you. Well, John, for folks who are just tuning in, we are speaking with Dr. John J. Berger. He's talking with us about his book, Solving the Climate Crisis. John, we got like 3 minutes left, so this is an opportunity for you to tell folks how they can get your book and learn more about you and some of your research that you have done in regards to solving the climate crisis.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. I think that almost anywhere in independent bookstores and also in any online portal, you can find the book available, or you can go to www.solvingtheclimatecrisis.us. You could also look at my website, johnjberger.com. You can go to sevenstoriespress.com, which is the publisher of Solving the Climate Crisis. So there are many ways in which you can get hold of it.
I almost feel as though I should have booked you for an hour, John, because I feel that there's so many different directions our conversation that we didn't have a chance to talk about. I feel bad. I mean, I had questions about green steel and green concrete. Don't answer it. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about green solutions or even trying to find a way to, do a rapid clean energy transition to kind of help us, get jump-started when it comes to our national climate plan.
There are many, many things that we could talk about, and I'd be happy to come back and talk some more with you and expand the horizon.
And here's the other thing for the folks who are tuned in. You could just simply buy the book and read the book, and then next time John is on, because we'll have you back on, John, you'll be able to kind of follow along, go, yeah, I remember reading that in, you know, chapter 7 or whatever. Folks can do that. John, I want to thank you so much for being my guest. I want to thank you for talking to us about something that's very crucial. A lot of people out there are having suffering anxiety because of the climate and the changes that we're seeing and rising seas and melting polar caps. Let's definitely book you to come on maybe this summer and talk more about the book, and I'll book you for more time.
That sounds great, Kevin. I really appreciate it. And tell those viewers who are feeling worried and despondent, yes, there's good reason to be worried, but don't agonize, organize.
There he is, Dr. John J. Berger. He has been our guest for this portion of Monday Night Talk. Again, proudly sponsored by Tiny and Sons Glass, McGuigan's Pub, the Patio at McGuigan's, and Alcoholics Anonymous. We want to thank you for tuning into this radio program, as you do every week. Again, if you have if there's ideas that you have for conversations or segments that you want to hear, MondayNightTalk@gmail.com. Yeah, it's easy, MondayNightTalk@gmail.com. You missed any of our past episodes, all you need to do is go to either the homepage of 95.9 WATD, look under podcast, or just search, Google is your friend, and look for Monday Night Talk. You can find us also on Spotify. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., you have yourself a great evening.